This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
When The Wire debuted on HBO over 15 years ago, I don't think it's an overstatement to say that it changed television as we knew it. The show traced the underworld and the politics and the street life of Baltimore. And it was an ambitious piece of sociology as much as it was unbelievable drama. The Wire was dense, it was challenging, and not a few people say it was the best thing ever on television. That show was the work of David Simon, and his latest project is a show called The Deuce. And what The Wire had done for the drug trade of Baltimore, The Deuce does for sex work and the rise of pornography in 1970s New York City.
So, what's it like, Shay?
Well, I'm just starting. Loretta can tell you, she's been sunlight all year.
Really?
Sunlight.
Making movies during the day.
For the machine.
Yeah.
But you only get paid. The Deuce is going into its second season on HBO, and I sat down with David Simon almost exactly a year ago, just a few weeks after the first season had premiered.
As I understand it, you and George Pelicanos, your collaborator on this program, had a conversation with somebody who sparked this idea. Tell me about that.
We were working on Treme, and the assistant locations manager was a fellow named Mark Henry Johnson, and he'd encountered this guy and befriended him and taken down tape after tape after tape of his memories of being a mob front, for the mafia, for the Gambino family on 42nd Street. Ran a bar up near the Brill Building that became quite famous in its day as sort of a demi-mon joint. Ran an after-hours club later on.
What was the name of the place?
If I say that, I think it identifies him. And he's passed away, and so has his twin brother. But I kind of feel like there's a lot of kids and grandkids. And since the story is not, you know, it's not all heroics, I'm not sure that I have permission, if that makes sense.
Fair enough.
But anyway, Mark said, you got to come meet this guy. You got to hear the stories. You know, it's about the rise of pornography. It's this moment where porn went from being under the counter, back alley in the basement to being the beginnings of a multi-billion dollar industry and a legitimate one.
And what kind of stories was he telling you?
About all the people he knew and what happened to them and who survived and who didn't and who was attrited and what happened and, you know, all the lies within the truths and truths within the lies. But we didn't know that. We thought, oh, great, it's a porn story. So George and I put him off and put him off. And finally, we were coming up here for a sound mix, I think, on Treme. And I said, George, you know, let's just get this all over with because, you know, it'll be an hour. We'll shake hands. We'll be at the door. 3.5 hours later, we walked out of Mark's apartment in Tribeca after, you know, listening to the guy for 3.5 hours. He wasn't done, but we pretended to go need a cigarette. Neither one of us smoke. And we walked around the block and said, my God, I think we're going to do a story about the rise of pornography. I mean, the stories were that compelling.
When the first episode opens, the world that we're in is the world of streetwalkers and pimps, not the world of porn. What happened?
Well, I mean, there's been pornography since the—
No, there's been skin magazines and
right.
the rest.
Since the first French guy invented the camera
right.
and said, you know, he ran down the street looking for Parisian hookers to take their clothes off. And there's been prostitution since, you know, since I believe our testament. So nobody invented these things. But what happened around 1971 was the New York City courts began interpreting the inherent confusion over what is obscene in a very, you could either say pragmatic or laissez-faire way, which is to say we're done chasing this nonsense around to no particular point because we can't obtain convictions anywhere above an appeals court, and the Supreme Court can't even give us any real guidance. So we're going—
So it was the courts more than the sexual revolution that did this?
There was sort of a hollowed-out notion of what is the standard. And, of course, you know, what are community standards in Times Square? They're very different from the rest of America. So it happened here, and it happened with mafia money. And suddenly what was under the counter in a very short span of time became legal and unregulated.
I want to play a clip from the show. There's a scene where Maggie Gyllenhaal's character, a prostitute who goes by the name of Candy— She has a kid as a client, a kid who clearly it's his first time having sex or anything close to it. And not surprisingly, he has an orgasm in no time flat. And he wants seconds.
What do you do, Stuart?
I'm in school.
What's your daddy do?
He sells cars. He's got a dealership.
And that's his job, right? Someone comes in, knows just the car he wants, doesn't dick around, doesn't need a long test drive, doesn't argue about the color or whatever. Does he give him the car for less? Does he pay less? Then the guy who comes in, takes forever, gotta drive 5 or 6 cars, talk about the radio, the white walls, everything else before he's done and ready to buy? No. He doesn't give the easy customer 2 cars for the price of 1, right? This is my job, Stuart.
There is, as there is in The Wire and everything else you do, David, a really powerful sense of labor and even the dignity of labor in this.
Even when it's undignified.
There.
That's exactly right, which is to say, I think our hearts, no matter where we go, whether it's recon Marines or trombone players or drug dealers or cops or sex workers, our hearts are either with – it's either on the assembly line or it's with middle management. You know, I think that's where our point of view is always strongest. I think that's what we're trying to convey. And then we're trying to show you, well, so where does the power and the money route itself? And if we sort of fail to do those two things, if we fail to create a world where real people seem to be laboring and trying to scratch out an existence, a plausible existence, and if we fail, I think, to address what they get and what they don't get in more macro terms, then I think we probably screwed up our mission.
Unless I'm crazy, one of the dominant themes of this is not just systems and economies and relationships of that kind, but misogyny.
Oh, yeah.
And this is created by David Simon and George Pelicanos, and Richard Price is a dominant writer here. But your writer's room is really interesting.
Right.
Tell me
well,
about
you just
that.
You just played from the first few. And yes, you know, when we were trying to establish the template, I relied on the writers that, you know, I came to the dance with many years ago on the Wire. But in order to shape the whole story and to bring it to a point that it needed to be, this could in no way be the boys' version of sex work, the boys' version of pornography.
So
the boys'
how do you assemble a writer's room? How many people are in it and who's in there?
Well, I chase novelists. That's my conceit, which is I'd rather have people who know how to write a multi-POV novel than people who know how to write television. I can fix what ails a scene in terms of television. I can't fix content and I can't fix voice.
But even in the so-called golden age of television, you don't have faith in that?
No, I don't. I don't want somebody who can deliver a clinical 43-minute and 30 episode on TV. I want somebody who can write a novel to conclusion that has a beginning, a middle, and end. So George was the first guy that I sort of threw it at. And then he and I went together to get Price. And then we went for Megan Abbott and Lisa Lutz. We needed the woman's voice in the room. We needed to be argued out of our own sensibilities. We needed to be argued into other sensibilities.
Tell me about some of those arguments. Give me an example.
trying to think. The one that I'm coming up with right now is not particularly substantive, but it's telling. There's a character named whose name in the scripts was Thunder Thighs. She's a heavyset girl who's working, heavyset woman who's working the corners. And she was named Thunder Thighs because that's what the original guy whose stories it was knew her as. We didn't have her real name. We had what he remembered her as, and that was her street name. So she was that in the script. First moment when we brought women on and they looked at the scripts and they said, can this person have a name? You know, and instantly I think I felt a level of shame that like I didn't anticipate. It was like, she absolutely can have a name and I'm sorry.
You're way better.
Yeah, you're way better. But it was much more substantive than that. I mean, you know, there's a conversation in one of these later episodes where the working girls are in the diner and they all just want to get rid of the pimps. And they start talking about menstruation. And they start talking about it in the most hyperbolic terms.
You hear about these sponges? You stick it up there, stops the blood long enough to fuck. Johns can't tell the difference. But you need to be careful. Gave me a yeast infection once.
Larry, one of the pimps, you know, throws down his fork, shoves his plate away, and walks away. And then they can talk because he's not around. It was one of the most fundamentally feminist scenes in the piece. And it was, I think it was Lisa Lutz, if I'm remembering correctly, she delivered that one. So, I mean, what you're looking at is that's something, you know, I would not have thought to write that scene. And if I did write it, I literally would have gotten to the parts about, I would have gotten to all the, you know, all the genital realities and said, or the venereal realities and said,
you would have run away.
Yeah,
from it.
Can a PA come in here and tell me, you know, you know.
I think anybody who's watching this show has got to be casting their heads forward to where this lands, which is to
right.
say porn on every phone and computer and all the rest, the ubiquity of porn and the effect it's had on...
On men.
How do you feel about the effect of porn on society?
Well, listen, I come from newspapers. I'm a First Amendment literalist. I don't see any means to regulate speech, open speech, but I think this has happened so fast that we've gone from, in 50 years, from stealing your dad's Playboy or Penthouse magazine for a 12-year-old to having any form of pornography, regardless of how sort of misogynistic the imagery might be available at your fingertips without intercession to that same 12 or 13-year-old. We've gone so fast. I'm not sure we've taken stock of just how profoundly.
You think it's affected consciousness in a way?
Absolutely. I certainly think it's even affected political consciousness in the country. I don't think some of the things that were said in this last campaign cycle and accepted, and not just the pussy grabbing, which is, of course, the most startling moment. I mean, if you think back two political generations, maybe one and a half, to Jimmy Carter and lusting in his own heart in 1976. You know, a very Christian, very sincere comment when asked about infidelity, that he had lusted in his own heart for other women. It nearly capsized his campaign. You know, Trump barely broke stride after the tape came out. It was really a remarkable moment of...
And you think that's linked somehow
to porn? I think the blunt ubiquity of pornography has made the terminology and the demeanor with which men address women now, I think it's transformed it, yeah. And I think you really see it in, give men the slightest bit of anonymity. You know, you have a lot of writers at The New Yorker. I imagine that what comes across the transom in terms of social media or comments at women, more than men, never fail. I mean, women are used to it. If you ever get used to it, women have now been putting up with it for 10, 15 years of the internet. It's astonishing. My wife is a novelist. What comes across at women nowadays?
She gets letters, she gets emails.
She has a website, you know. And I mean, you know, you kill it out and you keep moving and you know, obviously the anonymity is part of the dynamic. But what men feel entitled now to say and to think and to even argue, I think is entirely informed by a 50-year run-up.
That porn itself influences the misogyny directed at a
candidate. And the misogyny pushes porn. I mean, I think it's quite a cycle.
all these projects and all your reporting and all your thinking in your adult life has led you to have what politics, David?
I'm lefty.
How lefty?
You know what? I'm left wing on about 85% of the issues.
And where not?
I got no patience for anything that interrupts the idea of open speech. I find what's going on college campuses to be incredibly naive, almost childlike. I'm very disappointed in it. I think dissent, open dissent, requires speech in order to survive, particularly in a time of an authoritarian government. And the idea that you would trade that away over some schnook that's saying some stupid stuff in a Berkeley lecture hall is embarrassing to me. It's like, you would trade this weapon for that? That's not even tactical. So there are moments where I just walk, I listen to the left and I walk away and I say, man, you know, you've never fought the way it has to be fought in your life, and that's why you just came up with that answer. But there are other times where I find myself to the left of the Democratic platforms. I mean, you know, I think there should be a guaranteed income. I think we've reached the point in terms of the death of work and where we're going as a society and automation that we should already be guaranteeing people a basic income, which, frankly, Richard Nixon got close to doing.
He did.
And was told, this will work. You know, you give somebody $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, you give families that kind of money, it's all going back into the economy. It's not going into mutual funds. It's going right back into the economy. It would be an incredible boon to the country, and it would honestly take into account the fact that we don't need as many Americans to run this economy as we once did.
You started out as a journalist and a damn good journalist, and I think you have a kind of love and some hate relationship to what lingers in journalism. How do you feel about it now, and do you have any plans to sort of make anything more than an op-ed like a reentry into journalism?
You know,
because I could think of a good place for you to write.
Is that an invitation?
It's always been an invitation.
Well, I owe you a piece.
You do.
I owe you a piece. I mean, there are parts of me that think there's going to become a point where you don't want to sit in those goddamn deck chairs at 4 a.m. at 164th Street, you know, and wait for them to move the light. And at that point, maybe you should be writing prose again.
All right, then I'm patient.
Because then it's you and it's an editor and a copy editor. And, you know, and maybe a photographer.
Well, I'll wait for that day. And in the meantime, I'm loving this work.
Oh, well, thank you.
David, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
David Simon. Season 2 of The Deuce, which he created along with George Pelicanos, comes out next month on HBO.